Welcome to a very long overdue episode of Nerdy Notions. I am your host, the ever snarky Sasha Kaplan, and I'm joined by my fabulous co-host.
Kat, so it's definitely been a minute since we've talked about Spider-Man.
Yeah, last time we watched The Amazing Spider-Man, and we were like, oh, we'll just watch The Amazing Spider-Man 2 next week. And next week turned into, we're not going to count the months, but you can see the months between episodes. Look, a lot of things have happened, all right?
Yes, including in this movie.
Oh, yeah, this right. I keep forgetting about this movie. What was also really fun that we did this time that was a little bit different was we actually watched it together. Like
Oh
in
yeah.
the same place, essentially. Because yes, we always watch these movies before we record, but now we had to sit down together in the same space and talk about it as things were happening, because there were things that like I really appreciated about this movie that I don't necessarily think I would have picked up on if I was just watching it by myself.
Well, actually, let's get started there then. What are some of the things that you noticed with us just watching it together?
I forgot. No. I think one of the things for sure is Gwen's story. And the other thing was the humor in the film was actually really solid. There were, I think, several times throughout where you and I were just laughing outright. And it wasn't just at how bad it was because the one-liners hit.
Yeah, Andrew Garfield is probably the funniest Spider-Man, and this was actually a really funny movie. Not that we're saying it's perfect by any stretch, but actually the character dynamics itself are really well done.
I think the chemistry that Andrew Garfield has, essentially with everybody he's on screen with, was so solid. Everybody from, is it Jamie Foxx who played
Yes.
Electro, who is like, I'm not gonna lie, Electro's like the most forgettable Spider-Man villain for me. Like, probably because I grew up on the 90s Spider-Man. Like, I remember like the Shocker way more than I remember Electro. But also his chemistry with Sally Field, who plays Aunt May, is honestly Sally Field, Marissa Tomei, forgive me, but Sally Fields was the best Aunt May.
By far, she is the best Aunt May. She's the perfect age for it. The chemistry between her and Spider-Man is fantastic. Like, if you never want to watch this movie, just watch the scenes of Andrew Garfield Spider-Man talking to his Aunt May, and it is fabulous.
What's also really interesting compared to other, I guess, more recent films is the focus in this one really isn't on Spider-Man. Like, yeah, he's still an important figure, but at its core, this is Peter Parker's story.
Yeah, which is kind of a reverse of the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, where the story was about Spider-Man, how Spider-Man became Spider-Man, and it's a really good movie. And this one is more like, let's get into the deep of who is Peter Parker? But it will lead into that conversation by talking about what feels like the three ongoing plots of this movie.
Okay, so they're setting up the Sinister Six. That's one, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the biggest flaw of this movie is that they're trying to lead it into the Sinister Six. And if they didn't do that, we'd be much better off. But because this movie has three different plot lines going on, four if you count the plot line between Peter and Gwen Stacy, we're just going to walk through each of them. Otherwise, this is going to get complicated and convoluted real quickly. So we'll start with the Electro plot line.
Oi. Oi. I could not care less about Electro's plot. And it's nothing to do with Jamie Foxx. I think Jamie Foxx is a really great actor playing this one-dimensional character. Where he's this like very stereotypical like 80s kind of nerd. He doesn't know how to talk to people. He's very like self-isolating, and he has this fabricated kind of stalker-like relationship with Spider-Man because Spider-Man saved his life. And so he goes through this transformation, and it changes him by it. His motivations and what he's ultimately trying to do, like, is it recognition? First, he's like, I want to be Spider-Man's friend. And he's like, well, Spider-Man was mean to me for 2 seconds, so I'm going to be a jerk and like kill Spider-Man because of reasons.
Oh, like to understand this, if you've never seen this movie, Jamie Foxx's character Electro is like a little bit like a kicked puppy the entire time. He is consistently bullied at work. No, he never really seems to have any friends. He's the guy who celebrates his birthday by himself and pretend that Spider-Man is there celebrating it with him. And he gets into an accident at work, which Oscorp has just a history of accidents at this point. Don't work there.
That involve experiments with radioactivity and animals, which I think most animal rights organizations should lodge a complaint against Oscorp.
Yeah, so, and then he falls into a vat of electric eels.
As one
That's
does.
how, yeah, as one does, because that's a common thing to find at companies. He becomes Electro. Him and Spider-Man get into a fight. Spider-Man defeats him. He ends up going to Ravenscroft, I believe is the name of the prison.
Ravenscroft, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's not Arkham Horror. Or Arkham Asylum, guys.
It's as close as we can get to an equivalent without fanboys getting annoying.
Yeah. And so what happens is that Harry Osborn, who's also in this movie, we'll get to his plot line in a second because it's the worst one by far, breaks him out and he attacks the power plant that powers New York City because he designed it. So
Because he didn't
Spider-Man and
get.
Gwen's.
Does he attack the power plant because he didn't get credit for it
Yeah, that's also something that's in this movie.
then? Shouldn't he like go after like the government or Oscorp? Like if I'm a
No.
supervillain and I've personally been jilted by, you know, the people that stole my ideas, wouldn't I go after the people that did that and not like punish the city of New York?
Apparently not. He attacks the power plant. Spider-Man and Gwen stop him. They defeat him. And that kind of leads into like the final sequence of the movie. But to get to the final sequence of the movie, we need to talk about Harry Osborn.
Which is like, we don't even meet him until like a third of the way into the movie or something, right? Which is wild.
Osborn's entire reason for being here is for the Sinister Six movie. Like, there is no other reason that his plot was included. So.
I feel like, and maybe this is something we'll talk more towards after we cover these plot points, but Harry could have had a purpose here. If you take out all of the Sinister Six nonsense, you could introduce Harry and set Harry up as a friend and colleague in it, or like, you know, fellow college student Peter Parker. Like, because, okay, I'm gonna be a comic book nerd for a second because in the comics, Peter meets Gwen and Harry and Mary Jane in college. So it would have been interesting, is it, because they the Harry's plot is like basically him and Peter were childhood friends and then daddy shipped him off to boarding school in as far away as possible. So except we don't even get like a cool flashback of Peter having friends. We're just told, oh, hey, Harry, good to see you again, bro. It's been a hot minute. It would have been more interesting, I think, if Harry had been a newer friend, because then because the emotional connection that they try to establish later on in this plot, we don't have the same connection because we never we do see like a brief moment of their friendship before we get into the whole, hey, I need Spider-Man's blood bit. But we don't know how long they were friends. It doesn't look like they stayed in touch. And then like, Harry, I hate to break it to you, but Peter doesn't really owe you anything.
Harry is completely misused in this movie. So the yes, his dad shipped him off to boarding school when he was 12. He returns home just in time to watch Norman Osborn die in front of him. Norman Osborn tells him that he has this disease that is genetic, and like
Which is
magic, the
apparently
all.
super fast acting. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, apparently, as soon as he learns of this disease, he starts dying from it. So Harry is like, I need to find a cure for this disease. And his solution is that he needs Spider-Man's blood. Peter Parker refuses to give him the blood.
There's also this bit where he like dives deep into Oscorp's research because Oscorp claims it's like totally not doing experiments on things like this anymore, which we know isn't true because they have electric eels in a tank. Liars.
Yeah, so he ends up going around finding the original spider venom, injecting it into his veins, becoming Green Goblin.
Ken? Yeah.
Yeah,
I
he
miss
then,
Hobgoblin.
and this is where we finally get back to Electro, because all this is happening at the exact same time as the Electro plot. He breaks Electro free. They go attack the power plant. Once Electro's defeated, Harry comes in and essentially tries to defeat Peter Parker, and Gwen ends up dying in the process. Yes, this is the Gwen Dies movie.
Can I just say, as I was watching it, I remembered watching this in theaters and being on like pins and needles, which is probably why I blocked most of this movie out, going like, okay, is this the part where she dies? Is this the part where she dies? Is this the part where she dies? Because there were like three or four times I'm like, okay, wait, if she survives this one, this one, and this one, and this one, does that mean she'll survive the other? Oh no. No, she does not.
Yeah, so they die in a clock tower, which, if you read the original comic books, it's not the bridge, but still, it does imply that Peter Parker is the one who killed her, trying to save her.
But at the
But
same time, if Peter hadn't tried to save her, she still would have died. So it still continues that no-win scenario because by the time the web catches her, she's already about to hit the ground. And there was no way Peter could have done it earlier. There was no, she could have, the only part I don't like in this is that it does show her awake and alive as she's falling. Because in the comics, and I, because I get to do that, she's passed out. So in the comics, the Green Goblin kidnaps her and he's holding her on top of the Brooklyn Bridge and she's passed out. We don't know if she's dead or alive. It's implied that she's alive, but she doesn't speak, she doesn't say anything. Then Gobby drops her. Peter tries to save her, he can't because of Goblin. Eventually he does try to like thwip her and then we see the snap of the neck. In conversations that I was fortunate enough to have about this comic with the certain people. The goal of it was always it was to show the impossibility of success, that sometimes heroes fail and they can't save the girl. And so Peter is in essentially his own worst nightmare, which is like this is Peter's Kobayashi Maru, because nothing Peter does or doesn't do changes the fact that Gwen is gonna die. If she hits the water, she dies. If Peter grabs her by the web, she dies. If Peter jumps down from the Brooklyn Bridge, she's still dead. Like, this is a no-win scenario. But yeah, so that kind of
And
bugged me that she was like
yeah,
awake going down, but it added dramatic effect.
it really does. And it's a good scene. And then Green Goblin shows back up at the very end. I think he's also in an end credit scene, hinting at the Sinister Six. So that overall is Harry Osborn's plot. And like, Harry Osborn and Peter Parker have good chemistry when they're in the same room for 5 seconds. They have maybe like four scenes together in total. They don't talk to each other a lot. But yeah, no, Harry also does figure out that Peter Parker is Spider-Man, feels betrayed. All this is really, he really wants the blood in order to cure his disease. And we will get into the blood thing because they did the scenes backwards in these movies in
Yes.
my mind.
You're
Because
right.
at the point where Peter says no to giving him the blood, it doesn't make any sense. It makes sense 2 scenes later when you get into the third plot of this movie, which is let's talk about Peter's parents.
I do think it is refreshing that, you know, none of the I mean, the 90s Spider-Man show briefly touched on Peter's parents. There's like a whole thing about them being like spies, and not f like they were like KGB spies or something like that, or they weren't KGB spies and that whole thing. So it was cool to see some focus on kind of continuing the thread from the first movie, which is what happened to Peter's parents. Which we get to see what happened to Peter's parents, but Peter doesn't really find out what happened to his parents, right?
Yeah, so the opening scene of this movie is them getting murdered and their plane crashing into the ocean. Now, what's going on in that scene, we find out later in this movie, but Peter never really learns any of this.
But he does find something cool. He gets to see the. So his dad had a super secret lab, which is kind of cool, but also
Oh, yeah.
kind of weird. It's in an abandoned subway station.
So the entire thing with his dad, right, is that his dad was found out that Oscorp was working on like weapons of mass destruction, like biochemical weapons or whatever. He ran away with the research. He got killed without telling anybody. And then Aunt May gets told that he was running away to sell the secrets for money. None of this is true. So Peter ends up going through his bag accidentally,
Again, because he
breaks
did
open,
that in the first movie, right?
yeah, again, and then he breaks open the calculator and finds that the calculator is filled with Metro or New York subway tokens.
Which haven't been used in like a hot minute.
And then he goes to the station that essentially, without getting too into the weeds, there's a bunch of clues that lead into the station that his dad put this train car in. He summons the train car and he listens to his dad's final words because, in the beginning of the scene, his dad sends away his research to somewhere safe, which turns out to be his own underground New York subway lab. So he just sends the information to himself. And then
What are
Peter learns all this.
you gotta create backups for your backups, man, okay? You never know. But it is cool. I do like the mystery about the subway station because in that scene with Mary part, yeah, Mary, that's her name.
Yeah.
So Mary was like, upload it to Roosevelt. And so the audience is like scratching heads, like, is Roosevelt a person? Is Roosevelt a computer? Which, like, this was being like how they made. I don't know how uploading data worked in the 90s, but I would like a tech bro to come on and teach me how this worked in the 90s.
On an airplane, by
On an
the way.
airplane. Presumably before, I don't know. Did there like a mass like telephone connection that this worked through? Probably. You know, the days of dial-up are long behind us, and we're grateful for it.
Oh, for sure. But what he learns in this recording is that his dad helped. We knew this before, but like the spider venom that turned him into Spider-Man, his dad worked on it, and it only worked on Peter Parker because his dad used his blood, his own blood, to make it work. So it'll only work on someone of their bloodline.
Well, wasn't that also kind of like a fail-safe so that Norman couldn't use it for like other shit after he was gone?
Yes. Yeah, that's essentially what's going on. The problem is that in the order of this movie, this all happens after Peter has already said no to giving Harry his blood.
Yeah, if he'd found the lab first, it would explain, it would make more sense than like, okay, he has a good reason why he can't give him the blood because the way that it works in the scene as is in the movie, it kind of feels like Peter's, which like I guess it still sort of makes sense. Peter is concerned about his secret identity and he doesn't want to be a lab rat, so of course he's going to say no. But it feels kind of cruel when your friend is literally dying of some random genetic disease that we don't even know exactly what it does or what name it has. It's just debilitating genetic disease that apparently starts upon learning from it. So.
So all of these plots are smashed into one movie, and by far the best one is Peter trying to find out about his dad because it's also the one that leads to the most scenes with Aunt May. And Aunt May's amazing in this movie.
I think it's just a testament to what a fantastic actress that Sally Field is. Aunt May, she doesn't feel like an old lady. She doesn't feel like a cool young hip aunt. She feels like a real person. Like, I don't know if it's the script. I don't know if it's just Sally Field being Sally Field. And again, I like Marissa Tomei's version of Aunt May as well. It's different and it's cool. But Aunt May doesn't feel like a fictional character in this. She feels like a real person. Is that weird?
No, it's not. And I'll talk about Aunt May for just a sec because I adore her in this movie. And I know we're like jumping all over the place, but Aunt May has some of the best scenes. And it's like you can see how much she loves Peter in this. Like, there's a short little thing where you hear her saying, "I'm taking classes to become a nurse for with 23-year-olds so I can afford you to go to college." And it's adorable. It's like the sweetest thing. And there's like other th scenes where it's like the best one by far is the one where she's sitting on the bed and talking to Peter about how you're my son, like as he's looking for his parents. And it's, I don't like, you gotta watch it for yourself because just talking about it doesn't hit the emotional resonancy at all.
And I think that's the one, the movie as a whole doesn't work. Is it the worst Spider-Man movie ever made? Nope, that's still Spider-Man 3. But it's definitely at the bottom of the list. What saves it from the bottom of the barrel is that the characters are so well done, except for, like, even Harry, honestly. If we ignore the stupidity of the plot, Harry's interesting. He's taking over.
Is interesting.
He's taking over Oscorp from Daddy, so he's not just like a spoiled rich kid. Even though he kind of comes off like a spoiled rich kid, but there's a reason he takes over Oscorp. He doesn't feel like, oh, he's a kid stepping into his dad's shoes. He feels like somebody who has trust with the board until he doesn't. There's also this whole thing about like the board keeping research going that was specifically forbidden, and then Harry finds out. There's that whole weird plot point where there's like some secret stuff happening with what's her face?
Yeah, problem is Harry is in a completely different movie. Harry is in a corporate espionage movie,
Yes.
and Peter is trying to be superhero stuff. And that's where the crux of the problems of this movie comes in, is that the review sounds insane because that's what it's like watching this movie. So the question I have for you is, like, if you had to cut out one plot line out of this movie, which one would it be?
Oh, hardcore, all the Sinister Six stuff. That's easy. It's unnecessary. It really takes away from the story because, and I've said this for years, I don't care about the Spider-Man villains. I care about Spider-Man fighting Spider-Man villains. This is like taking a Batman movie and just making it about the Joker. Yes, I went there. I went there. I don't care how amazing the first Joker movie is. I'm not interested in watching a movie about a guy I'm interested in seeing fight Batman. Because I care about the superheroes. And you can, I think there's a way to craft a really good villain movie. Like, you give me a Doctor Doom movie, I'm sold. I will be the first butt in the movie theater because Doctor Doom is cool. He's three-dimensional. He has layers upon layers of information and journeys from being a melodramatic bad guy to being this like deep thinker and philosopher and magician and whatever it is, everything else that he is. There's so many layers there. I don't want to see a movie with, Electro, the Goblin, the Rhino, and a bunch of other guys just doing things. I mean, like, not to go on a too much of a tangent, but like, come on, nobody went to see Kraven the Hunter. Nobody went to see that movie. Right? People went, a few people I am sure went to see Morbius, but, and this is my allergy to vampires coming in, but I sat down to watch it and it's boring. Like, it's like nobody wants this, nobody needs this, but Sony had the IP, right? And they're like, we're gonna milk this for everything it's worth so Marvel can't have it. Nyeh. And it shows.
Yeah, Electro did not need to be in this movie. If they just made this a movie about Harry, Peter Parker and Harry and Peter Parker finding out about his parents, it would have been fantastic. We would have been there the entire time because we could talk about the fourth minor plot line that also helps this movie, and that is everything going on between Peter and Gwen.
Yeah. There's a lot of like will they, won't they shenanigans going on because we remember from the first. So Peter promised Captain Stacy in the first movie that like he'd leave Gwen alone because he'd get her killed. Damn, Captain Stacy had a point, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
By at the same time, it wasn't Pete. How do I put this? Gwen didn't die because Peter relied up too much to her on her. I think Gwen died because she also loved Peter and couldn't let him go. Like it takes two to tango, right? This is a two-way relationship. And it is, I will give it credit that I think the relationship between Peter and Gwen in this movie is probably one of the best romantic relationships that we've seen across a lot of different Spider-Man stories, movies, and TV shows. With the exception of, you know,
Excellent.
Peter Parker and Mary Jane from the 90s Spider-Man show, because, you know.
I think it's actually one of the best superhero romances ever. Like it's up there. And part of why it works is that they are both so human, and you can see how much they love each other. And the entire reason that they break up is because Peter cannot stop seeing her dad. Like he sees her, his he sees his figure in like anytime he's going to do superhero shenanigans, and the guilt that weighs on him because he promised him that he wouldn't let his daughter get hurt and to stay away from her. And he can't live with that guilt, but they still love each other so much and are still drawn to each other, but they keep hanging out and trying to be friends. And what happens is that Gwen gets an offer to go study in London. And of course, what is the most romantic thing Peter could do? He offers to go with her and be Spider-Man in London, which honestly would have been an amazing movie, which we kind of get later on with Tom Holland, but we won't talk about that yet. And of course, the tragic part is Gwen dies. They don't get their happy ending.
And it will haunt Peter Parker for the rest of his days,
I
as we
mean,
find out.
as we do find out, because it's one of the big things in, again, the third Tom Holland Spider-Man movie, where we get to see all these guys, where we get to see both him and, oh my God, Tobey Maguire back.
Too many T names. I will say that Gwen Stacy is a character I keep going back and forth on, A, because she was never like my first introduction to Spider-Man was like Spider-Man and Mary Jane. So MJ, like OG MJ has my heart. But I do appreciate from this and from Spectacular Spider-Man, I understand now what makes Gwen appealing to so many people. And I always am a fan when a movie manages to change my mind about something. And so I appreciate this version of Spider-Man for giving Gwen Stacy something interesting for me to like. Not to say she wasn't interesting for other people, but I think actually the way you could keep this aspect of it, even have Gwen dying, but you could structure it as a so the first movie was Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man. But this movie really could have been a little bit more coming of age story, which I guess, which is a little bit silly considering these characters were supposed to be like 18, played by actors in like their 30s, but that's beside the point. So you structure the movie as the continuation of the mystery of Peter's parents. And now that Harry's in charge of Oscorp, you could ask Harry, hey, Harry, hook a brother up. And then Harry's like, hey, I actually have this disease, but I know you were are you still a science nerd? He's like, well, yeah, I am, but you should really get Gwen Stacy to look at this. And so Harry, so you have this friendship and even like a low, I don't want to say love triangle. No, there's like, keep the love triangle out of it. Have Gwen as the scientific confidant who's trying to pull this together. And you can still have all of this stuff about Harry's blood, and then Harry ends up still injecting himself with Peter's blood or Spider-Man's blood. And I guess they didn't really want to inject too much Goblin because then it would have been kind of like a retread of the first trilogy. But then, okay, don't. So then don't have that. Have this whole thing be still about Oscorp and the mystery of Peter's parents and create. Actually, I take it back. I think this is one of the flaws of the first Spider-Man movie, which is that they didn't wrap up the story of what happened to Peter's parents, because I don't think there's enough mystery there to sustain two films, as we found out. There's enough mystery to sustain like a movie and a half. So you can solve the mystery of the parents and then maybe add this bit about Oscorp and bring in a villain who hates Oscorp as much as Peter now does because of what happened. But I don't know who that villain would have been.
Okay, so we kind of actually talked about this when we were watching the movie together. Do you remember who shows up in the end credit scene?
Who?
So, the
Rhino.
remember this? Yeah, it's the gentleman. So, if you don't know who the
Oh,
gentleman
yes.
is, he's a super villain from Spider-Man comics. And one of the things we discussed is that he would have made an amazing final villain for a potential third movie.
Right, because he was the one that was technically setting up the whole Sinister Six thing. Which, okay,
Yes.
if they had gotten a third movie, then the story organically would have been depressed Peter Parker wallowing in the tragedy of losing his one and only love, Gwen Stacy, facing off against the Sinister Six, which would include who would that include actually?
It was the Vulture was there. They did a bunch of little cameos. Vulture, Doc Ock, of course, Electro, Green Goblin. There's two others who are like eluding me.
That's kind of, that doesn't really, like, Rhino, I guess, and
Rhino,
Goblin.
yeah.
And I get, oh, Electro
Well,
still. Oh, God, this never would, this was never gonna work. How did
no.
anybody actually think this was gonna work?
It was never going to work as a Sinister Six movie, but if you took it as a conspiracy plot corporate movie, it could have worked. Because if you use the gentleman as the guy who planned Peter's parents' murder, set all that up, and then like wanted to corrupt Harry in order to take over Oscorp himself, it could lead into something. It doesn't go that way because at the t this time we wanted team up movies.
You know what actually also would have been interesting is if instead of this debilitating, mysterious genetic disease, the plot twist is that the gentleman was actually slowly poisoning Norman Osborn. So to make, and then he was doing the same thing to Harry, and then Harry finds out, or Spider-Man finds out, like that would have been cool.
Yes.
Hey, Sony, Bubbla, Marvel. Hey, do you guys need a couple of comic book nerds to write some Spider-Man stuff? No, you don't like us? All right.
I would absolutely go write Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man 3, but I want like 16 of these movies because I love Andrew Garfield. That being said, Ed, like there are so many like dumb little moments in this movie that could just have been cut out.
Yeah, because like as you said, there's what, three or four different plots and stories happening at the same time, and these things can be done well in a 2-hour movie. By there's not enough balance and linear story like content to connect all of this in a way that doesn't feel like you're trying to cram a bunch of things into it, because all they had to do was make another Spider-Man movie, and you could have low-key introduced. So they do a good job, in my opinion, of like low-key introducing the Rhino. As much as I was annoyed at how they did the Rhino. Look, if the Rhino doesn't work, if he's not just a guy in a Rhino suit, all right? That's my Spider-Man hot take for the day. But if they had started the movie in the same way, right? Had one or two like little low-scale villains, like the Shocker, because the Shocker is great, and like one or two other. Well, okay, the Rhino and the Shocker, those are the low-key villains, right? Because you already have another Goblin, and you have another what's his face? You have the Electro. That's
Yeah.
four already. You don't really need six for a sin. I mean, I guess you do because it's Sinister Six. But I guess the sixth one can be introduced in the next movie because you already have, and then you have the Lizard. And the Lizard, as I love the Lizard. I think that, I take that back. That's probably my favorite, like, legit Spider-Man villain because I don't, It's very Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I really love how they play off that. But in the comics and in the TV shows, not in this in the movies, but he then could serve as a catalyst, as somebody who switches sides and ends up helping Peter defeat the Sinister, remaining Sinister Five.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's the same problem with as we got with the Justice League movies, that we tried to introduce all these people in the same movie. Really, the reason why Avengers worked is because every single one of them, for the most part, got their own movie. We got to learn who they are as characters. That is what we needed. If we really wanted a Sinister Six movie, it would have just taken forever.
So have like six Spider-Man movies that each have a different Spider-Man villain as like big bad guy, or even with like, or maybe like four Spider-Man villains with like more a couple of minor bad guys, and then lead into like a big brawl. But also, I just from like a movie making perspective, right? That's how do you have one character fight six villains essentially at the same time while still telling a cohesive story? Because I feel like you're going to need like an hour just for all of the fighting as you take out all the bad guys one by one. And some of them don't have the easiest way to defeat them.
Yeah. No, there's no way the Sinister Six movie was ever going to work. If they somehow change my mind on that, I am open for a good Sinister Six movie. I don't think it will exist. By the way, in terms of random plot elements also in this movie, Black Cat is also in it.
Oh my God, you're right. Oh, I forgot about that. Which is hilarious because when we watched it, I Googled. I was like, "Wait, who is this actress playing?" I forgot she was in this movie, and I Googled, and it said Felicia, and I'm like, "Excuse me?"
Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, Black Cat is another love interest of Peter Parker's. That's probably where they were going with the third movie. In this movie, she serves as like Harry's little assistant. She does not do much. She's really just there as cameo fodder. But it's like scenes like that just like pad this movie till the end of like time. But at the same time, there's other cute little scenes, like the fact that Peter knows all the firemen's names and helps them out while they're trying to defeat Electro.
But that's the thing, right? This is why one of the many reasons why, despite the flaws of this movie, it's an enjoyable flop. Because it's not the plot points and the hammering of the Sinister Six. It's those little moments of just Spider-Man being Spider-Man. Like Peter Parker totally would be the kind of character who would know all the firefighters' names in his local precinct or unit, whatever it's called. Right, or firehouse. He would be the kind of person that would know the guy at the deli when he swings by because he is the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. He's one of the most grounded heroes of the Marvel Universe. I think the only person I think that could match him is probably Daredevil, who just like only knows everybody in Hell's Kitchen and everybody in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah, well, Daredevil has his own problems that we will eventually get to. But
You're not talking about the movie, right? Right?
no, I am not talking about the movie. At least not yet. We're not
No!
talking about the Daredevil movie right now. But P this Peter Parker, and we can briefly talk about a comparison of all three of the Spider-Men, because we will get to that so soonish, is that this Peter. Peter Parker is the most of the people. And we do get that scene in Spider-Man 2, I want to say, of like Peter Parker and the train and everyone agreeing. It's like, we won't tell anybody. And it's like, it's good scene. It hits an emotional resonance. But you can see it in this movie where it's every single person, it's every single day. Peter just knows people and he cares.
I know, I think we talked about it when we reviewed that film, where I found the scene both very sweet and kind of hilariously not nonsensical, because yeah, it shows the impact, like the part up until Peter's secret identity is revealed, they're like, we won't tell. Tell them what? That Spider-Man is just a white guy. Like, it's not like anybody were like, oh man, it's Peter Parker. Oh, I won't tell anybody, I swear. But it does have that emotional impact where it shows the effect that Spider-Man has had on the people of New York. Here, it's just so personal. And my favorite part of, I think, all of that and that encompasses it is is Spider-Man and that little kid, where he saves this little kid from bullies because he's wearing it and he's like, takes off a Spider-Man mask. And it's like this cute little boy, and Spider-Man is just like so nice to him. He's like, "I'm gonna walk you home. Is that okay?" And I'm like, "This is beautiful." And then at the end, that kid finds the strength to stand up against this giant. Well, totally like, okay, like mom, parents, please watch your children during the supervillain shenanigans. Just saying. But and then so it's a kind of a full circle moment that shows that Peter Parker, Spider-Man, is. That at its core, Spider-Man is Peter Parker because Peter Parker isn't putting on a mask and becoming a different person. He's still Peter Parker underneath the mask, and he's a guy that cares. And so to have that same kid stand up to the Rhino, and then Spider-Man comes back and swoops in, and Spider-Man is like, "Oh my God, kid, what are you doing? Get the heck out of here." He's like, "Hey, buddy, thanks for being here. I'm gonna go take care of this guy. And can you go back to your mom?" Like, it's so wholesome and so sweet.
Not something we get with any of the other Spider-Man. We get some of it with Tobey Maguire. It's sprinkled in there. We get none of it with Tom Holland. Not that I'm saying Tom Holland is a bad Spider-Man, but he is very much connected to the Avengers, to whatever Tony Stark is doing, to his friends, that you don't really get any of his connection to the people, especially in the third movie where everybody hates him.
Well, to be fair, there's a reason for that. It's not a correct reason, but it is a somewhat justifiable reason if you don't know anything about Spider-Man and Peter Parker. But at the end of the day, it is, and I think this goes back to something I had might maybe have mentioned on previous podcasts, is that the three different Spider-Men that we get represent three very different versions of the Spider-Man comics, which is the Tobey Maguire trilogy is classic 60s Spider-Man. It's the very classic superhero story. Amazing Spider-Man is self-explanatory. It's that, more like 70s era, like the Amazing Spider-Man stories. Tom Holland is Ultimate Spider-Man. And I don't mean to say that because that there were a lot of fans were angry because elements of Miles Morales' story was sort of interwoven into Peter Parker's in the MCU versions of Spider-Man. But because if you go back to the first run before Miles is introduced in Ultimate Spider-Man, where it is this like very much teenaged Peter Parker who doesn't really know what the heck he's doing and is just trying to do his best. And all of these versions are equally valid, and they're going to appeal for different reasons to different people. And I think because I am, and I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Kat, but I think one of the reasons the both of us are so attached to this version of Peter Parker is because I think it is the most grounded and the most personal. And for a lot of kids, Spider-Man is their first. Like he's their first superhero, with exception. But for me, he was right up there with the X-Men. And so because I'm going to keep talking about the 90s Spider-Man cartoon until we eventually get to watch the whole thing and review it. But that was my Peter Parker. And I, putting nostalgia aside, I don't really remember how that resonated with me, but I remember really loving Peter Parker and really loving Spider-Man. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but the gist of it is that I think Andrew Garfield was the best embodiment, I think, of why Peter Parker appeals to so many and why people are so attached and defensive of him. You can even make the argument they're a little bit more defensive of his lore than maybe some others, other characters. So yeah, Spider-Man is this Spider-Man is just realistic. Like it's a weird thing to say in a comic book adaptation.
He really is. And I think the biggest thing about this movie is that he was The goal of this movie was not to create a good Spider-Man movie. The goal was to create the Sinister Six movie that never happened. If this was a good Spider-Man movie, we would have be having like a ton of sequels or something along those lines. And it's kind of tragic in a sense that this is the end to his storyline to some extent. I mean, we do get him in the third Tom Holland movie. But I want a continuation after that because his story's not done. There's still a lot here to kind of parse out and digest. And despite the fact that it was a 2-hour movie with like 16 plot lines, some questions are still just unanswered.
What's also really interesting, and I think I mentioned to you when we were watching it live, is there's not a lot of Spider-Man in this movie. Like, yeah, there's scenes with Spider-Man, but I think the scenes where Peter's actually wearing the Spider-Man mask are maybe like the beginning of the movie when he's on his way to graduation, the first fight with Electro. And then when he meets with Harry, and then the final battle. That's four scenes out of, 20 plus or whatever, where it's just Peter Parker.
And it works. You don't need He doesn't need to be Spider-Man the majority of this movie. It works having a story focused on Peter because Amazing Spider-Man, it was Spider-Man like almost the entire time, if I recall that correctly.
Well, because as you mentioned, the first movie was about creating Spider-Man. So Spider-Man does have to take over essentially a good chunk of it. But there's still a lot of great scenes where it's clearly showing that Spider-Man is a mask. It's not a different person. It's an extension of who Peter is. Like there's that scene where he comes back with after he got the crap beaten out of him. And Aunt May is ready to chastise him and yell at him and find out like what happened and why he's so beat up and she's so concerned. And he takes out that carton of eggs that he promised her he would get, but then forgot. And so it's just like, it's so. I think the first movie, the first trilogy, I think really created this I don't want to say a difference, but it showed that Spider-Man was the upgrade to Peter Parker. Because they make him very nerdy. In the second one, it feels more. In the second trilogy, it's not a trilogy. I kind of expect it to be a trilogy, but the second Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield, the one we're talking about, is Peter Parker is an extension. Spider-Man is sort of like an addition to who Peter Parker is. Peter doesn't feel like a different character when he puts on the mask. He's not any more bold. He's not any more snarky. Or sarcastic or quippy or whatever. It's just Peter wearing a mask and a pajamas.
So, I guess one of my final questions for this is, do we think Aunt May knows that Peter Parker is Spider-Man?
Oh, that's a good question. Having only watched this movie once in theaters, and I think maybe once when it initially came out on DVD, if that, and then watching it with you, what, like 2 weeks ago, a week ago?
Yeah.
I thought for sure that there was going to be a scene or a line he somewhere in this movie that kind of made it clear like Aunt May knew, because it kind of felt like she knew. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she does. She just is waiting for Peter to tell her. Especially in the last scene where it's like, because after Gwen dies, Peter takes off the mantle of Spider-Man for 6 months. And they're watching a news broadcast of the Rhino like tearing apart the town at the end of the movie. And Aunt May's like, "Well, I wish the Spider-Man guy was around," as Peter is like sitting right there. There's also a really, really cute scene early on in the movie where they're talking about laundry. And I know this sounds ridiculous out of context, but it's actually adorable. And
It
it is a really funny scene. And Aunt May doesn't want Peter doing laundry because he turns all of everything red and blue.
He did that once. He did that once.
Yeah. And there's like little nods and hints around that she knows, but I think in my headcanon. She's waiting for him to tell her.
Yeah, I could see it. And she, God, I do wish we could have gotten a third movie just for more of Sally Fields as Aunt May and more of Peter as Spider-Man or Andrew as Spider-Man, because their dynamic is so good. And there's this real love that is portrayed through this relationship where and it goes back to that line where she says, "You're my son." She's not his aunt. She's his mom in every way that counts, right? She raised him. And yes, that's technically true for all the other versions of Aunt May, but to have it explicitly stated adds so much weight and emotion for the audience, especially with Sally Fields' incredible delivery, that this is her baby. She didn't raise him from a baby, but she raised him from the age of what, 10 or 8 or whatever.
Yeah.
And Peter's like, "Yes, I love you. You are the equivalent of my mom. But I also need to know what happened to my parents." It doesn't, and this is, I think, like, this is, I've seen this port this question brought up a lot in films and TV shows that deal with the questions of like adopted parents and kids seeking, you know, answers about their own life. It's a way of like, well, am I from like the portrayal of the parents, it's like, am I not good enough that you need these answers? But it's like, I want to know who I am and what happened. I just want the answers. But you're my parent. You are my mom, my dad, my aunt, my uncle. It doesn't matter what the label is. You're my parent and I love you. And that's reciprocated, obviously. And so it's, again, it's just so grounded.
That is one of the best scenes in that movie. Like, the emotional highlights of this movie is Peter and Aunt May. Sometimes with Gwen too, but really the emotional crux is with Peter, Aunt May, and his quest to find his parents. It's why it's the best plot of this movie, and I wish it got a little more attention. But yeah, at the end of the day, would you recommend this movie to people?
You know, if you had asked me after we initially watched it, I would have said no. But having discussed it now and sort of looked at it analytically, I actually think I would, but with the preface that, like, ignore the plot. Because at the end of the day, the scenes that resonate with us and the scenes that are the most memorable have nothing to do with the Shocker. They have nothing to do with Harry. They have nothing to do with Oscorp or any of the bad guys. It has to do with the interactions between the characters. And ultimately, those interactions are what I think saved this movie from becoming the worst Spider-Man movie ever made.
Watch this movie with friends. It is so much better. Your significant other, your dog, whoever. Don't watch this movie by yourself expecting a good time unless you really, really love Andrew Garfield. It's not going to be a highlight. It's still better than Spider-Man 3 by far.
I think one of the things that really helps when you watch it with somebody is that, and you know, Kat will attest to this, they've seen far too many movies with me, that I am the kind of person that will just turn to the person next to me and just make a snarky comment. And, or I will ask the question that should be asked, but no one's doing it. And so having somebody to commiserate in the bad moments will help you appreciate the good moments.
And that is true. Like, the action is also really good in this film for the most part. Like, it's not like it's just too busy is the biggest complaint. There's a lot of good in here. If you can ignore some of the really dumb plot lines, if you can ignore or the Sinister Six implications. And I'm going to kind of wrap up with like one of our final questions, and it's like, I thought about this after watching this movie, and it's like, what role did Uncle Ben play in this film? Now, he's not in it. He's dead. But you could still feel the effects of his death in this film because you see Aunt May putting away his things. They talk about him. He is still a presence in this film, which He might as well not exist in the MCU. Like, Uncle Ben is not a thing in the MCU. And I feel like in the original trilogy, they kind of forget about him a little bit after the first movie.
I don't remember. It's been so long since we watched the original trilogy, but yeah, no, I remember Peter and Aunt May going to get a toaster from the bank and being rejected, that more than I remember like Uncle Ben after the first movie. But yeah, the ghost of Uncle Ben, so to speak, his spirit is still there, and you can tell that they're still essentially grieving. But Peter in general is grieving like 95% of the time, right? From Uncle Ben to Captain Stacy, to the guilt over Captain Stacy, to then Gwen.
Spider-Man is very sad in this movie a lot of the time, which means you know it's comic book accurate.
God. Peter is, in so many ways, is probably like one of the most what's the word I'm looking for? It's like he's constantly forced to be miserable by the plot. Like, he's not allowed to be happy for too long. And while I do understand that Peter Parker is the embodiment of guilt in the Marvel Universe, like, if we were to take all of the different tropes and stuff like that and all of the different, issues and just personify them based on characters, like, Peter Parker is basically guilt. It's not Catholic guilt or Jewish guilt, it's just guilt. And you can interpret it whichever way you want. But I do also, and this is maybe one of the things where I do very much wish this has gotten a third movie, where Peter learns to move forward into something positive instead of wallowing in that darkness. Because while this works for, certain storylines, you can't, in my opinion, constantly have a character be miserable and unlucky and sad and depressing, because at the end of the day, it just makes the reader feel sad and miserable and depressed. And you have to find the hope and the sort of the light at the end of the tunnel for the audience to make them want to root for Peter consistently. And there's a reason why Spider-Man is arguably the most successful Marvel superhero, or the most famous Marvel superhero.
Yeah, so let's start that petition for Spider-Man 3 and we'll see if it goes anywhere. It won't, guys, but we can try.
The amazing Spider-Man 3, because Tom Holland is getting a fourth Spider-Man movie. So, oh gosh,
I mean,
your face right now was like, wait, what? I didn't know this. I don't know how to feel about this. I'm kind of horrified.
I knew he was getting a fourth one. There was no way he wasn't. Tom Holland is not my favorite Spider-Man. And I'll talk about him when we get to his movie. But what's next on our docket?
As far as I know, it's the spider the I can't believe it's not, wait. Is it Spider-Verse or is it the third Tom Holland movie?
It's a good question.
Because the Spider-Verse, I feel like it's a little unfair to review the Spider-Verse yet. Because it's, well, I don't know. You can make the argument. But I think initially when we discussed it, it was gonna be Spider-Man No Way Home? No Home?
Yeah, so we are
What
actually
Home?
going to be talking what a Spider-Man's Lost from Home or whatever that movie is called will be our next one, followed by the Into the Spider-Verse series, at least the first two until the third one comes out.
Eventually. Well, granted,
Eventually.
given how long it takes us to record episodes.
So, in the when you get the next episode in 5 years, we will review the third Tom Holland movie, potentially the fourth one, along with anything else Spider-Man related.
So, with that in mind, I think by now, if you listen to previous episodes, you know where you can find me on the social medias. Probably don't look for me on social media. And Kat, as far as I remember, still does not have the social media.
Now, you can find me on Tumblr under Flying Night Witch if you really want to talk to me. I don't know why, but if you do, I am there.
And I no longer exist in the interwebs. No, that's not true. But these days, you can find me mostly on Threads at the Jewish Comics Queen, which is, totally a very subtle nod to everything about me right then and there. So thank you for listening. May the Schwartz be with you. And maybe have good Spider-Man movies again.
May we?